Welcome to Supervision Simplified, the podcast that's here to rock your supervisory world. Our mission is simple yet powerful: to educate and elevate counselors, social workers, and psychologists, empowering them to serve their communities at the highest level of fidelity and service. I'm Dr. Amy Parks. I'm a child and teen psychologist, a group practice owner, and a supervisor in Virginia.
And I'm Valerie Harris, a trauma and attachment specialist, group practice owner, and a supervisor in Tennessee. Let's make it simple and dive right in.
Welcome to Supervision Simplified. I am Dr. Amy Parks.
And I am Valerie Harris.
And we're so excited to have you here today. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Supervision Simplified. We want to talk to you today about the business of clinical supervision, but not just clinical supervision, the business of therapy, the business of working in the mental health field, and something that we've noticed as we have been listening to some of these board meetings and reviewing some board-related documentation, as we've been having conversations with colleagues, as we've been discussing this amongst ourselves and with people that are in our field, in business practices. So take us to what you've been thinking about lately, Valerie.
So I did a little bit of a deep dive yesterday when updating the student handbook and listened to our board meetings for the state of Tennessee, which are now live streamed. I ended up finding them because I like to stay on top of the meeting minutes. And I noticed that these meeting minutes, while long, they were also saying, well, this doesn't include everything, so go here if you want to know more. And I was like, oh, great. And in the midst of that, I started to uncover some other documents because, you know, the board will put things out that they're updating here and there. So they're not updating all of the state law or anything. They're just kind of providing clarification on things that are already in place. And so I know, at least in Tennessee, you know, there's a really big tension and push around whether people are 1090 can do 1099 or W-2. And I'm sure that doesn't just apply to Tennessee. And
so that's, you know, whether you're an employee, a 1099 right. is an independent contractor, a W-2 is an employee.
Correct. And in mm-hmm. Tennessee, we have a LPC MHSP, which is what the designation gives us the ability to treat and diagnose. We're able to get a temp license, but you cannot go into private practice with a temp license. You still need to work in a group practice. And so this woman was coming forward to the board saying, I think the situation was that her spouse is a dentist. And so she had been doing her work there somehow, like working out of that office. I don't know what it was. She was asking if she could. I think that's what it was. And so she had about, I don't know, maybe 50 supervision hours that she still needed. And she was asking them, well, I don't want to sign this contract with this practice because it just doesn't seem like it's a good fit or doesn't feel right. And I'm trying to be, you know, follow the law and all this stuff. But do you think it would just be okay if I just go ahead into private practice over here and just while I get those other 50 hours? And of course, they were like, no, that's not an option. We would set a precedent if we did that. We're not willing to do that. We have said this multiple times. And so
just
the guy
finished your hours.
Right. So the guy said, right. You can go to a group practice and do this as long as it's owned by another clinician. And so, you know, I have found it really interesting that the board will not make a clarification on W-2 and 1099.
The board in Tennessee. Yeah.
Correct. And that's really, and so I actually found a document where they even, so a couple years ago, they released a document to clarify what is an appropriate clinical setting and how, you know, you have to have a supervisor in the building, has somebody licensed for 20 hours a week. It doesn't have to be the one person the whole time. So all of these things to clarify this, but they never really got clear on how that person is connected in the building. It's sort of like they're dancing around it. And so yesterday I found another document where they were talking about postgraduate compensation. And it said that postgraduates working towards an LPC MHSP licensure may receive third-party payments in accordance with one of our rules. The license rule requires the individual hold an LPC MHSP temporary license if they wish to receive direct payment from an individual, organization, or insurer. And then it said,
so they could get direct payment from an insurer?
That's what it was saying. And then it said, for all registrants under this board, payment arrangements with the practice setting should be directly coordinated between the clinical setting and the postgraduate, which is like understood. The board cannot advise on payment arrangements, including if the arrangement qualifies as a W-2 or 1099 agreement, and recommends individuals consult with a tax attorney for further guidance. This was released in August of 2023. I have real big concerns about this because the whole point of the board not wanting someone unlicensed in private practice or even a temp license for that matter, or the whole purpose of, like, for instance, in our state, they're master's level counselors. They're not therapists because they're not licensed. And so language matters. And the language matters because you want to create clarification for the public. So it's very bizarre to me that you can go to a group practice website and see, meet our team, and have all these faces, and there's no disclosure there about how they're connected. And so it could appear to the public that these are all employees of this practice, when indeed they're all supposed to be in business for themselves and could be working with other practices.
They're all contractors.
Yes. And so it just goes against the very thing that they're seeking to prevent. And then they will not get close to it or touch it. And I'm not sure what that's about.
Well, you know, I think the bigger, and I think it's, there's such a bigger discussion here around licensure in general, and that's such the tip of the iceberg, and it's really so problematic. I think, you know, there are 50 plus one, so 51 states, if you count DC, 50 plus one states, and there are in the 50 plus one states, 26 different acronyms for counselors in those 50 plus one states, 26. So if we're supposed to be protecting the public, first of all, the public doesn't even understand what LPC, MHCQ, XYZ even means, number one. Number two, I can say in Virginia, the way this, and I don't actually know, to tell you the truth, if it's the board that made this statement, or if I just know this as historical fact, because I've been doing this since Jesus was born, or if it's because I own a practice. I'm not exactly sure how I know this, so I have to check on that. But I do know that it's a fact that you cannot be a resident or a pre-licensed clinician and work as a contractor in the state of Virginia, because you cannot work as a contractor and not have a license to do that job.
Correct.
So that's the way it works in Virginia. You cannot.
Yes. And I ran into something like that. So I had a supervisee who was in a practice, had a completely different degree. So the degree was in art therapy, had moved. And then I realized that the supervisee was connected by a contract as a 1099 and not an employee. And I was like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. And so I'm like, are there licensed people on staff? Like, you know, so then I was like, you cannot be in business for yourself. You're not licensed. And I had to let my workaround, because I really enjoyed the supervisee and I did not think that this was something that they understood or knew when they got into it, which is the other issue that I really have, is that I feel like if someone is just coming out of school, they know nothing about business, taxes, anything. And we're to save.
They don't even know what 1099 and W-2
means. No, all they see is more money. And so now you want to save on taxes, and they don't have protections. They have no protections at all. And so I don't blame the supervisee, but I was going to go to the group practice owner with the document in hand that states this is what the state of Tennessee says is an appropriate setting, and draw up a contract to have her sign that and state that she was doing that. And as soon as I did that, she was like, hey, we're going to pay for your supervision from now on, and I'm going to get you a different supervisor. I'm like, okay,
Okay. Wow.
I mean, because I knew I could not continue to supervise her. Like that was, right. And it was saying, you know, this is a trauma therapist on the website. And I'm like, no, it's not. No, it's not. Person does not even have a license. We cannot call them a therapist. They are a master's level clinician. So there were just, I was like, that language needs to be changed. So there were all these things. And I'm like, so if the public, if someone wants to file a complaint or anything, they're going to think that the practice owner is the boss of this person when they're not. It's just, it is not protective in any way. And
well,
it's
you can't
bizarre.
Even, you know, we've done an interview with Jackie Flynn, who is a registered play therapist. You can't call yourself a play therapist unless you are a registered play therapist.
That's right.
You can only call yourself a play-based therapist.
Just like DBT. It's informed. You cannot say that you are a DBT right. therapist.
And it, you know, it's so problematic, and people just these things are created to protect the public. They're not, and you know, a lot of people call it gatekeeping, and you can call it whatever you want, but the point is that these trainings are created to train people to be specialized and have specialized skills to protect the fidelity of the work and for the services that are provided to the client.
The subject gets me all heated. Like
I know, but it blows my mind. And unfortunately, the thing I think that is the most problematic is that our system that is designed to protect the public is making it more complicated.
Yep.
That's the thing I think that blows my mind. And I wish there was a way that we could say, look, it would be so much easier if we could all just, everyone could have the same designation. Everyone mm-hmm. could have the same rules. And I don't understand why it's so complicated. And I don't actually think any clinician understands why it's so complicated. I really don't think any of us understand that. Is there someone in the land that can I actually do know why it's that complicated, because it's a legislative thing that happens because the government wants it to be that complicated. But,
right.
you know, really, is there anyone that can explain why we can't fix that? Because it's crazy.
And that's just one piece of it. So
in just one state.
In the hours of listening to this, because I want to be abreast and on and ahead of this and understand like what's unfolding, what's coming, all these different things, because it's my clinical responsibility as a clinical director and supervisor. So much like of the time is spent trying to navigate people moving into our state who have a different designation, and they're trying to figure out, does this course work? Does that work? And yet we have so many applications in for licensure that just sit there because yep. they cannot process them fast enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not the board's fault. It's a systemic issue, and I can see in certain ways where they're definitely trying to do things better. And I'm sure the counseling compact will help in some of those ways, but it's just bizarre how much time is spent like on this little minutia, trying to figure these things out, all because we can't seem to agree on what to call ourselves. And like, we can't standardize that. We can standardize all kinds of other national tests and we can, right. but somehow we just can't figure this one out, which makes no sense.
Well, that's a funny comment that you make too, that we can't even standardize the test. We can't even decide on one test. Why do we have two tests? Why
right.
do we have two tests? Why? Why in the DMV, in the three-state area where the majority of people need to be licensed in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, where I am, do we have two tests?
Oh,
so
wow.
I teach at a university where I have students in three states in my yeah. class, and they have to take two tests. There's two different tests, the NCE and the NCMCHE. And the class that they take to study, to prepare for the test, only covers the NCE because the university's campus is in DC, which has the NCE. But I have students in my class who are in Virginia who need the NCMCHE. I'm like, why do we even have two exams? Why?
Well, in Tennessee, we actually have people who are just LPCs. And so that MHSP came along to diagnose and treat. I'm pretty sure we're the
only. And why do we need that?
We're the only state that has that. So if you're just an LPC, a lot of times those are school-based counselors.
But why do we need that? Why do we need to be, why can't everyone just diagnose? That makes no sense.
Right. But they focus so heavily on that diagnosis and treatment piece. And so I guess the LPC part is sort of the NCE, it's the theory. And then this other part is more of the application, but it's still way more complex than necessary. And then I really think this counseling compact is going to be a hot mess, but
I don't think the counseling compact solves anything. I mean, we will have somebody on the podcast to talk about the counseling compact, and it'll probably be a several part episode because we need to know more about it.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that it will make some of a difference, and hopefully it will make a big difference to the next generation of therapists, because that's what we need. It will probably not make a big difference to people who are already licensed. But I think it's a very worthy effort. I don't think it will ever really probably be enough, because there are so many complicating factors. I just don't quite understand why it is so complicated. And I also think it's fascinating when you look at how many, it's not even just the licensure. So the supervision part of it is just as complicated. Becoming a supervisor is different in every single state.
So that was something they were going over in the board, is this person was coming in, and at the time they got licensed in this other state, the state only had a certain requirement, and it did not require them to get documented evidence of their clinical supervisor's training, whereas the state of Tennessee wants that evidence. So their state that they were licensed in before did not require that. So then when they come into Tennessee was like, yeah, but you don't have enough of this, or you don't have this. And they were like, I know, but that wasn't a thing then. And I don't even know how to get a hold of that. Like, it's just insane the amount of time that is just spent on that. Like, I'm wondering, what do you think keeps, I understand it's legislation. I get that. But we change laws all the time when we're really motivated to do it. So it's very, I feel like if people understood how much more bandwidth they would have, like state to state, if we just like normalized or like standardized the actual term.
I don't really understand what the
problem is. I mean, the NBCC's done it. The NBCC's got real clear. They're very clear. You know, like, take this. If you want an NCC, take this test, take this test. If you want this, you want that. So like,
right.
They've already kind of laid.
Your NCC doesn't really get you anything. So, I mean, what does it buy you? It doesn't buy you anything.
Well, I think for newer clinicians, I think it is important. I think it communicates value in that way.
Right. But it doesn't allow you to do anything.
No, but I think they've standardized their processes in such a way that it would seem like you could take that model and continue to expand upon that and have a similar thing happen for these compacts.
Well, right. So like the goal, my point is, I guess, if we took the NCC and made that the licensure standard, that would solve the problem.
Sure.
But right now, the NCC is meaningless because it doesn't equate to anything in any state. It doesn't mean anything in any state at all. If it had meaning in any state at all, that would be the goal. That would be that it should be the gold standard, like the ACS. The ACS, same thing. If the ACS were the gold standard in every state for supervisors, that would solve the problem. So why can't we get to that? And so, you know, I sit on the supervision committee for ACES, the Association of Counselor Educators and Supervisors. And I said to the committee, because we're creating the standards for the national standards for supervisors. And I said, why aren't the standards the ACS standards? And they're like, well, you know, it's a good question. I'm like, yeah, that is a good question. Like, why isn't, and it's because NBCC is not, it's a private entity. Like, it's not
Okay,
it's
but
it's its own association.
So, they do a great job, though. Like, they have some stellar standards. So why reinvent the wheel?
Because every single state has to say, we adopt your standards. No state's going to give up. So that means every state has to give up the income that they get from their licensure processes and their staff and their boards and all of that stuff and give it to NBCC.
I would really hope that's not part of it, but it probably...
It has to be it. What else is there? What else could it be? I can't figure out any other reason why that would be, what else that it would be. I mean, because it seems to be like a slam dunk. Like, why is that not the way it's done? Because if NCC needs a little bit more teeth, but not much more to make it more, you know, state, like maybe jurisprudence exams for each state or something like that would make sense. But like, what's missing? Nothing from what I can tell. And so why aren't we doing it that? I don't really know. And like, I'm not queen of the world, but like, and social work has the same problem. Same problem.
Oh, so, I didn't realize that.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily as complicated, but you know, it's pretty complicated too.
Wow.
So
I mean, what do you think could be the first step in the right direction that they could take? Like if we could talk to like all the boards, you know, because we never know who would be listening. Like,
well, clearly the compact, I don't know enough about the compact and how it's supposed to solve the problem to say anything. I mean, each state, it was a huge lobbying effort just to get the states to adopt it. Right. So if that's not the solution, I'm not sure I have a solution.
And they're saying, so everything I was hearing was saying it, the earliest it could potentially like take some roots would be at the end of this year. But they said it's most likely going to be like in the spring of 2025. But they were even talking as a board when they were going over their financial piece about how they're having to make all these, or they're making all these technology improvements, which is a good thing to kind of speed up different processes, and that it's putting them in a deficit. And so then they were having to look at figuring out, once the compact happens, you know, how do they offset that additional, you know, labor that's going to have to happen to manage and process all those things? Because the fee for a compact, usually if somebody's just I guess getting a license, it's generally not the same as the licensing fee is what they were saying. It's usually less. But the other thing they talked about, which I thought was interesting, is introducing the idea of a permission, like a privilege, like a privilege to practice. Like, you know, so rather than being licensed, like you have privileges in these different states. And I'm like, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Right. So like the way the counseling compact works. So originally, my understanding was that the compact was going to open in this early, like in the spring or summer of 2024. But now I'm hearing it's not expected to open until late 2024, like you're saying. And so there's a difference between a license and the compact privilege. So your license is granted by your home state, but the compact privilege to practice is granted by other compact member states. After you've applied for your privilege to practice in those states through the compact.
Okay.
So you have to apply for compact privileges once the compact application opens, mm-hmm. which is expected to be like mid to late 2024. And that means that your license has to be in good standing in your current state. And then if you are applying for, say, for example, like for me, I'm licensed in Maryland, in DC and Virginia. And if I wanted to apply for licensure in Maryland, Maryland has a jurisprudence exam, which means an exam on the laws of Maryland. One thing I know I have to do is take the jurisprudence exam in Maryland. So if a state has a jurisprudence exam, you must take that.
That's correct. That's what they were saying. One of the cases they processed was a woman who was licensed in another state. I think it was North Carolina, had moved here. They were not going to be able to take her coursework. Like, she was missing some assessment and treatment planning. And and then some abnormal psych. And she was saying, well, they kind of wove the assessment treatment planning into all of our coursework. And they were like, yeah, well, we can't really see that. So they essentially told her, you will have to take another class. They were nice enough to let her know that we'll hold your application fee for 12 months. And if you apply within like 12 months, then we'll put it forward towards that. But she then said, well, what about the counseling compact? And if that goes into place, you know, then can I just, basically, I think what she was trying to say is she was hoping that since she was licensed in North Carolina, she could move here and by compact get a license. And that's when, you know, and they reinforced the no, because you would then be a resident of Tennessee and you would have to be licensed in Tennessee because that's your home state. So again, this whole conversation went on for 45 minutes. Just
yeah, this isn't about skirting around licensure laws or anything like that. This is just making portability easier.
Right.
So, and so like one of the questions is like, if my state isn't in the compact, can I have privileges? Nope. So if you live in a state that is not a compact member, your home state must be a compact member.
Right.
So
and how many are there? Do you remember? Was it like 13? 15?
I think it's 13 or 14. Let me see if I can find out. Hold on a second. I'm going to look for the map.
And are all of your states that you have right around you that you have students in, are they all part of it? I know Tennessee is.
So I'm looking at a compact map right now. And let's see, I'm going to read you the states. Washington, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Iowa, Wisconsin, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio, West Virginia, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine.
Wow, that's way more than I realized.
I don't see, did I say Delaware? I think I said Delaware, Maryland. I don't, Washington, D.C., the legislation is pending, and South Carolina is pending. A number of 12 are pending. And in only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Only 7 states have the legislation not introduced.
Is that California, New York?
Texas, Nevada, and I don't know my geography well enough to tell you because they don't light up. But I can definitely tell you Texas, Alaska, and Nevada, and a couple other states.
Wow. I know for a long time, they didn't even recognize LPC in California. There was only, I think, LMFTs.
You can get more information at counselingcompact.org. That's where all the
information is. You can get on a mailing list.
And you can get on their list. And you should get on their list because that's a good place to find more information. And if you're pre-licensed or, you know, already licensed, you should definitely be on that list. But I do know also that it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't do anything in regards to supervision. So your supervision it's not impacted at all. Becoming a supervisor in a different state, still the supervisor requirements are the same.
Yep.
For exactly. That new state. Yeah. So that's a shame. I was hoping that would be sort of something that also just transferred over, but that's not the case.
No.
So, yeah, which is really unfortunate because we need more supervisors that can work across state lines.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
There's a possibility, I guess, maybe there's still a possibility that could change. I don't know if that's something. I don't know if new legislation would have to happen for that to be added.
Well, you know, with, I know it would in our state because we have the rule, like the laws, you know what I mean?
So new legislation would have to happen to say,
yeah, supervision. Because supervision is driven by those Tennessee code annotated rules and regulations for licensed counselors. And here's the weird thing for licensed counselors, for pastoral counselors, and for marriage and family therapists. So we have the same board and we have two different sets of rules, and they're entirely different for what the MFTs can do. And it's mind blowing. They can go into practice without a license.
You know, you mentioned before, I wanted to go back to what you were mentioning about art therapists. We only just, I think in the last year, began to license art therapists.
Yeah.
But art therapists, many art therapists are completely unlicensed. And that's a really interesting thing too, don't you think?
That
many art therapists are totally in private practice, and people don't have any clue that that's an unlicensed field.
Now, Tennessee is working on it. Like, they're working on some sort of like transition. And as long as their degree is actually in art therapy and it has certain things with it or whatever, that they are working to transfer that over. But you're right. Like, that was recently introduced, and there's very little movement on it so far, I think.
Yeah. So I think that that's really interesting. I was just curious what, I know that there is an art therapy, a group of art therapists that work in our local hospital, and I was wondering how they bill. So do they just bill under some other kind of credential, or is it just an adjunct service?
I mean, I would think that they're like employees, right?
Well, yeah, but I'm sure the hospital has to bill them in some way, shape, or form. Oh. Like, I was curious.
Oh, I see. You're right. That is.
Or like, I don't know. I was just wondering if you had an art therapy practice, you know, like, do you bill? I don't know. Just wondering.
I know. That's what I'm. Yeah, because there's not a code for that.
I don't know.
So it's almost like they still have to. And I think I had clarified when I was supervising that person that they were still going to have to get the LPC.
Right.
Like, there was no two ways about it. Until that art therapist piece that they're working on is done, they would have to. But there was a test that this person was able to take to get like a certified art something, registered art something. And that was able to. That meant something, but it was still not going to be the license.
Well, what I would love is I would love to hear from our listeners that are art therapists and what they're doing in their states. I would love to hear from listeners who are marriage and family therapists who are in private practice and what it means to them that they have that opportunity, you know, and also what people are thinking about in their states, how they feel like the licensure process is going for them, how they feel like if the licensing process to them makes sense, if they feel like it's confusing, how they feel like having two licensing exams. I'd love to have a conversation, a greater conversation about this, because I think this is something that we complain a lot about, but we don't really have a lot of constructive conversations about. And I feel like if we were having more conversations about this, maybe we would be making some movement a little bit more on this topic. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think it could generate solutions. And I'd also love to hear from people who've had experiences either working as a 1099 in a group practice and or working as a W-2 and sort of the differences in that and maybe how it was helpful, harmful, or just stories. I know we had a practice that shut down in the area that was 1099, and there was just a lot of things happening that shouldn't have been. But I, you know, of course we don't have to identify you if you don't want to be identified, but we would love to just hear more to understand it and have the conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks, Valerie, for bringing that information from your live feed from board meetings. I don't think we have a live feed of ours, but I'm going to check.
Oh, that's
I know we
sad.
Have a minute, but I know, I don't think we have a live feed, although, I'll have to check on that. Sounds like fascinating listening.
Yes. There were some other great things I'll share at another time.
Yes, definitely. Because we're going to share
their licenses.
Yes, we're going to share those too. Absolutely. Those very interesting stories. But we won't be able to tell you what states those are because we're not going to really get into all that kind of tea because we don't want to give anybody's identity away.
We don't want a defamation lawsuit, although my attorney says as long as it's facts, it's not defamation. But I still think that it's wise to protect yes. as much as possible the identity of those people, because we don't want to shame them.
Yes, we absolutely will. Thank you all for tuning into this episode of Supervision Simplified. Remember that the revolution starts here. We hope you'll subscribe to Supervision Simplified and share it with all your friends and colleagues and fellow supervisors and supervision seekers. We also want your comments, your stories, your feedbacks. So what we also can be sure to know what you're talking about, what interests you and what interests you the most. Until next time, keep on simplifying and elevating your supervision game.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Supervision Simplified. Remember, the revolution starts here. We hope you'll subscribe and that you'll share it with your friends and colleagues. We also want your comments, stories, and feedback so we can be sure to be talking about what interests you the most. Until next time, keep on simplifying and elevating your supervision game.